speaker is Gretchen Sable. Gretchen attended the University of Cincinnati, and she obtained a bachelor's degree in biology. She then went on to work for the US EPA until she moved to Minnesota, where she worked for various programs with the MPCA, the Minnesota State Planning Agency, and the EQB. She earned a Master's of Public Affairs from the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota, and she retired from the state in 2014. Welcome, Gretchen.
Well, good morning. So as Ellen said, this is one arm in the future and one arm in the past. I was at the Abel Seed House Brewery yesterday, and I picked up my copy of the Growler. And lo and behold, there is an article in here about needing to get on with implementing the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989. So it's still current effects. So like Jim did, we're going to kind of start in the middle of the last century, looking at this time of great change on the land in Minnesota. This was, you see that little picture there of Dayton's Southdale, when that was the next big thing. So that was 1960s. The population, I'm just trying to figure out how this works here. Pushing the wrong buttons. There, haha. Population in Minnesota was growing pretty steadily, so you wouldn't think of great change looking at this graph, but the circled area there is the middle part of the century, and that was where we went from 3 million to 4 million people. At that same time, there was a lot of change in how people lived, and so people were leaving the farms and coming into the suburbs. They were leaving the cities and moving out to the suburbs. The baby boom made a lot of changes. Farming practices changed at that time. Farming practices became much more intensive than they had been. I was looking at some home videos, and you could actually before walk between each plant of corn in a cornfield. And now corn's planted just cheek to jowl because we've automated everything. The red circled picture there shows tractor sales. Tractor sales actually peaked in 1952 because we had so many farms before. Everybody bought a tractor, and then because of the automation, they could farm more land, and we had fewer farms. So that was interesting. This is the picture on the left there. That's the city of Roseville. Dirt roads in Roseville right here. The other picture, the right-hand one, is Lexington and Larpenter. And you can see right there what that looked like back in 53, that was, the year I was born. And some of these changes brought people in proximity to some of the old problems. And so we saw changes in what people were near, and at the same time, so now think into the 70s, we're starting to see Love Canal. We see those kinds of big problems where some of the historic things that we'd been doing, because people were moving out to where those bad things were happening, they're getting near them. I live in the city of Andover. Andover had, I think, 2 landfills, 3 Superfund sites. You know, it was all the stuff that everybody wanted to have outside of town became town. And there we were with all this stuff. So what happened? There was a lot of legislative response, and this was really a time of big bills, big sweeping bills that changed the way a lot of things happened. So Superfund passed in 1980. 1983 was the Minnesota response to Superfund. A lot of people here probably worked in those programs. And at the same time, when we had these big programs addressing big icky problems, we had still a lot of nagging problems that were coming from our kind of everyday life. And so 83 was the Groundwater Protection Strategy Framework. The Pollution Control Agency did that with federal money. The Groundwater Protection Strategy, again, federal money came into PCA to do that, and that looked at how to address these kind of smaller point sources. We had a non-point source strategy that I found after I did the slide. There was a strategy for wise use of pesticides, the state water plan, because there was also a lot of withdrawal issues. Water levels were dropping as well. And then to top it off, we had a big drought in the 80s. So kind of a lot of things came together, and then the drought made everybody think about water. And because we were all thinking about water and trying to solve these thorny problems, there was a bill that was put together. And so that's the Groundwater Protection Act. Am I leaning in too far? Okay. You guys remember Linda Bremmer, the Department of Health? Linda sent me her testimony from Congress. She went to Congress to testify in 89 about the act. There was more than 30 hours of conference committee hearings on this bill. So when you think now about conference committee reports coming out and passing in the wee hours of the night, this was not that kind of a bill. This is something that was really negotiated. And Senator Steve Morse was saying, Minnesota legislators, he's one of the authors of the bill, Minnesota legislators were concerned about the widespread incidence of pesticides in groundwater and the growing evidence that it was everyday activities of Minnesotans that was causing the contamination. Didn't we have a duty to protect groundwater for future generations? So there was actually a lot of high-minded stuff. Okay, so now I'm not a historian. These are just things that I dug out from the dusty closet in my husband's office. What online resources made the jump into the internet from way back when? That's actually Linda's testimony from Congress. She found it in her recycle bin when I contacted her. She said, I was just about to throw that out. So here you go. That's a picture of me with the old groundwater sensitivity map from oh so long ago. One of my friends found that and said, oh, you could use this. And then, like I said, still current. So there's me and Steve Morris testifying a couple weeks ago, 10 days ago, on how we need to implement the Groundwater Act and not stop things. So it's all still stuff that's going on. Some of the things that the Groundwater Act did were, like I said, sweeping and big deal stuff. So this was the degradation prevention goal. You can read it there. It is the goal of the state that groundwater be maintained in its natural condition, free from any degradation caused by human activities. At the time that this was happening, there was a lot of discussion about what standards do we apply to groundwater. And the thought had been that perhaps there was kind of an allowable drift. Maybe you could let it get to this level, and that would be okay, and then we can all live our lives in our usual way. And if it got no more than this, then we would be, and there was pushback on both sides of that. And so we ended up with this high-minded sounding statement that we are going to protect all groundwater to the extent that we can. And that was an important piece in the first time in statute. And then this bill affected the work of many, 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 many agencies. Well, I too many manys, but a lot of agencies. So this was that 1989 groundwater sensitivity map. Eric Porcher worked on that for the Pollution Control Agency. There were flaws in this. Is Eric here? If he is, he would be the first to say that there were flaws. And so using that as a basis for decision making was a problem. And so DNR in this bill was to develop criteria for sensitivity mapping and to do that mapping and then to tell local governments to protect these areas. And the county atlases were also accelerated through this. This is the current DNR. What I'm going to do is go back and forth between what the law said to do and what we're doing today. So this is the current DNR sensitivity map. I got this from the internet. So if DNR people say I'm saying this wrong, I just found it. So where they've identified sensitive areas. I talked with Jan Faltasek and Paul Putzier, and they told me that these GIS, this is used now as GIS layers for local decision making, and so they really have taken that to a higher level. The groundwater atlases, back then there was two. There was Winona County and Scott County. Now you can see there's a large number of atlases that have been done and that funding really increased. So funding started in the early era and it kind of dwindled, although there was more going to MGS than shows here. But then when the Legacy Act passed, funding went up, so that was good. Oh, and Jan was talking about how these atlases bring together, Jan Faltasek, bring together the surface and groundwater and make it a living document. So that has been something that the Groundwater Act did. Before the Groundwater Act, there weren't health risk limits. This is something that we use as an everyday tool now. But back then, there wasn't any kind of standard for private wells. You could look at the EPA for finished water supplies, but because that also included treatability, cost benefit, it wasn't the appropriate tool to use for private water supplies. And so that was the HRLs were developed because of that. And basically it was laid out in this act that if a chemical is found in groundwater, the health department shall set the limit. And the Department of Ag was responsible for identifying ag chemicals and PCA for others. Now these are done. The first promulgation was in 93. It's on a 5-year schedule now, so we should be looking at some more coming up. And the public can request chemicals. So there's actually a place where people can request these reviews. And this is an example of one of the reviews. I saw acetaminophen. Oh my goodness. As a retired person, you get to know all the painkillers. So anyhow, here's an example. Atrazine is a common corn pesticide, and it's also commonly detected in groundwater. This is the groundwater monitoring network the Department of Ag uses now, about 248, I think, sites in 2016. They monitor that through a network of wells and springs, and they found atrazine in about 25% of the samples. And so the health department does a health risk assessment and comes up with numbers for safe exposure to atrazine. Based upon those numbers, then the Department of Ag came back and did a special registration review. Do we need to make changes in how atrazine is used in Minnesota because of this? And they determined no, but they said that they would continue watching research coming out of the federal government. So I followed the link to that, and I found, oh no, one of the pages that EPA no longer maintains. So maybe a weak link in some of this. So once you've found it and you know what levels are important, how do you manage it? And that was the other big thing that the Groundwater Protection Act brought. It brought a process for addressing non-point source or diffuse point source pollution. And it's a two-step process where voluntary measures, best management practices, come first. And if they don't work, then you're supposed to go to these mandatory measures. And that's where we're kind of stuck with the legislature right now, is making that gap from voluntary to less voluntary. This was back in the day when recycled paper meant that it was gray. So it's an EQB report on the act. Basically, as contaminants increase, different actions are taken. So when there's no pollutants found, you're going to be doing education and monitoring and talking about BMPs. When you start to find them, then you get serious pushing BMPs. When the pollutants continue to be found more widespread or increase, more actions are taken. So it's actually a series of growing responses. And this is when the water resource protection requirements are supposed to kick in. When you think about problems like nitrate, you can see we're a little overdue in doing some of these. Here's another example of how we've been doing it. Department of Ag has put out numerous nitrogen reports. This is the 2015 report on nitrogen fertilizer management. And what it did, it pointed to the need to develop rules. So in June of last year, they proposed a rule. And if you remember that diagram I had from EQB, this looks a lot like that. And this is the top ones for private wells, and they're going to follow a process of increasing regulatory response as the concentrations increase, and the same for public wells. This became very controversial, and so that's why we're at the legislature now. The governor, there was a lot of pushback on the rule. The governor said, we're going to just do public water supplies. So this will not affect private water supplies. If you're in an area where your private water supply has increasing nitrate, you might as well just go out and buy an RO unit. But anyhow, the legislature people feel that even this level of regulation, working on public water supplies to reduce nitrogen, isn't appropriate without legislative approval. The Groundwater Protection Act set up the Legislative Water Commission the first time. It was actually disbanded and then put back together. So that's something that was new with this act. It was the first time so a big part of this, there wasn't language in the bill, but lots of money came for implementing the Clean Water Act. So those of you that might work in the health department and in public water supply testing and that kind of thing, the first wave of money for that came from this bill. We also had data guidelines and compatibility. There was a lot of concern that all these different agencies did all this different work, but all the data didn't fit together. And so we worked on ways to find the data to fit together. Pesticides. A pesticide is both an herbicide or an insecticide. So there are a lot of titles in the bill that worked on pesticides, the pesticide management plan. That was a big part of the concern, because finding these things in water after everybody had read Silent Spring and knew that pesticides aren't good for people, was something. The ACRA was set up, the Ag Chemical Response, the an agricultural analog to Superfund. Oh, and the administration of Superfund shifted from PCA Department of Finance so that MDA had equal access to cleanup funds. In part of my gleaning around for information on this, I talked to Dan Stoddard over at the Department of Ag, and he said he was one of the 100, and so there was 106 people that were hired to implement this act, and he was one of them. The Groundwater Protection Act has been a great success for addressing pesticides, both for point and non-point, primarily because it was adequately funded by a fee on pesticides. So that is so key to have money to put behind the engine. Pesticides in groundwater were a major concern when the act first passed. There were high concentrations in a number of city wells, and they were found at levels above the health standards in rural monitoring wells. But since then, by addressing the point sources, there's been a big reduction. He also talked about ACRA a little bit. ACRA was the first and still one of the very few dedicated ag chemical cleanup programs in the nation. It's been very effective in cleaning up hundreds of contaminated sites and has dedicated staff at MDA now. And they also strengthen ag chemical storage requirements in this act. So there was a lot of change in the ag field as well with this, which is one of the reasons for the 30 hours of conference committee reports. Over at the health department again, new fees were instituted for wells, and that brought a lot of money into the health department to help fund the changes. It also required disclosure of wells at the time of sale. So that was a change that affected how transactions happened in real estate transactions and brought things to the fore. Advisory Council on Wells and Borings established significant new funding for the Safe Drinking Water Act. And there were a lot of grants to local governments for well sealing. I'm sorry, I have no slide coming up here, so we'll see how that goes. Oh, there it is. I'll just quickly say here, DNR also, there was concerns with groundwater depletion, because at that time, sounds like who would ever do that, there was a lot of once-through cooling. Groundwater would be sucked up, put through a cooling coil to cool large buildings, and then just discharged into the river. And so we were short-circuiting, bringing up old Mount Simon water, using it to cool these buildings, and then pumping it down to Mississippi. So that was banned. It actually phased out through increased fees that ended, and then the practice was ended. So that was a big change. And they also, this was the first time that we had a graduated scale for water use fees to push toward conservation. And now DNR has a number of things. I see Carmelita here. She's been working on these new tools for water supply managers. This is the money, $17 million over 2 years. And 30 years ago, that was more money than it is today. So there was, you can see here, this is something that we don't usually see either. About half the money came from the general fund, whew, and the rest from fees, water use fees, water well fees, and pesticide fees. Spending was about a quarter looking at drinking water protections, so that was the health department work, a quarter on control of pollution sources, a quarter to local governments, this is kind of a beginning of the increase of the role of local governments in water management, and then also 25% on education, research, and monitoring. So it was a nicely balanced bill that brought all the different elements into play. And when we look at the 106 positions that were funded from this, there was about 50 at Department of Health for the Drinking Water, Clean Water Act implementation plus the HRLs, 37 at Department of Ag, Bowser got 3 in grant management, DNR 8 for regional assessments, PCA 5 for technical assistance and data management, and then the university got 3 to develop BMPs. So in summary, this was a sweeping act that changed things, and those of you that have been working in the field, you know, if you were one of the 106, you knew about it. If you came later, you just think it was kind of like always like this, and it wasn't. These were things that were earth-shattering, a non-degradation goal, a mechanism for addressing non-point sources, increased conservation, implementation of the Clean Water Act, conformity and data and information. And one of the things that also came about was this increased cooperation among water agencies, because before that there had been some competition, this is our territory, this is your territory. And it seemed to me, working in the field, that people kind of figured out, well, they're doing their piece and I need to get this from them. And so there was increased cooperation. So that was that. Thank you.
I think we have time for just one or two questions before we go on to the next speaker.
It looked like you had a slide there about the non-degradation clause. Is that current language that you had up there?
Yes.
We still non-degradation if it's feasible.
That's still our goal in statute. It's in Minnesota Statutes 103H beginning.
Well, I think we'll do just one more. Kelton, I saw you had your hand up.
What's your educated estimate of what the increase in people working in the field, private and public, from before the act until now?
I don't know, because how many of us left the field in the early 2000s? It was, at least in government, there was a lot of cuts. You saw it reflected in that slide of the DNR funding for atlases, and lots of programs had cut way back. So I don't even know, I'm sorry. Yeah, how many are here?